Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we discuss borderline personality disorder, or BPD. What is it? How prevalent is it? And how is it treated? Joining us, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
Social worker Jenny Putnam. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
And Blaise Aguirre, a child and adolescent psychiatrist who's a staff psychiatrist at McLean Hospital and is internationally recognized for his work in treatment of mood and personality disorders in adolescents. He's the director of McLean's 3 East Continuum, which focuses on BPD treatment. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I wonder if you could tell us what borderline personality disorder is and where this term borderline originated.
Yeah. So maybe to start with the second question first. So historically, maybe as far back as the 40s and 50s, 1940s and 50s, that is, there were people who were clearly psychotic, meaning that they had hallucinations, heard voices, saw things that weren't there, very paranoid. And there were people who were considered neurotic, you know, the so-called worry well, maybe anxious about little things in their life, but that anxiety overwhelmed them. And then there was this category of people that didn't seem to fit into either camp. They weren't as disorganized in their thinking as the people on the psychotic side, and they were more overwhelmed with life than the people on the neurotic side. So they seem to straddle the borderline between these two spaces. And so the term borderline developed. Today, we see it as people who have difficult time regulating, controlling certain aspects of their lives, their emotions, their sense of self, their behaviors, their relationships. They have marked deficits or marked inabilities, especially under strong emotional experiences, to control how they behave, how they think, how they interact with the world. So, and these difficulties in interacting cause, problems in relationships and work and studying and school and all aspects of their life. So,
I think when people hear personality disorder, they immediately think of multi-personality disorder. Like, remember Sybil, that book and movie came out, and are they related?
It's interesting that I sometimes think about this. If you cut your finger, you don't say that you have a body disorder. You say, I have a cut finger. And, one of the problems with this concept of personality disorder is it's sort of there's an implication that all of the personality is disordered. But really, I mean, many people with borderline personality disorder function extremely well and actually work amongst us. It's certain aspects of the character of the personality that that impact their lives. The idea of multiple personality disorder, or today people think about dissociative identity disorder, is quite different. Actually, it seems to be more trauma related, in people who've been severely traumatized can dissociate and can disconnect from their own sense of self and experience altered states, other identities, which is quite different. Not to say people with borderline personality disorder can have those kinds of experiences, but that's much more rare.
Yeah. So is there a range of severity, sort of like a spectrum? I know this divided into 3 clusters. Talk about what those clusters are.
Yeah. Old nomenclature studied personality disorders in 3 different clusters. The truth is that for many of these clusters, they were actually quite hard to study. So, for instance, if you think about narcissistic personality disorder, the reason narcissistic personality disorder was hard to study is because somebody with narcissism wouldn't go into therapy because they're better than everybody else and they don't need help. So it was very hard to do research on people with narcissistic personality disorder. On the other side, people with schizoidal or schizotypal or paranoid personality disorders were so suspicious of the rest of the world that they wouldn't go in and seek treatment. So it was a very hard group to study. People with borderline personality disorder had such intense emotional experiences, has such terror at the fear of being abandoned, that the intensity of those emotional experiences would lead them to want to end their suffering, want to end the intensity of the emotions. So imagine being so emotionally overwrought that things like self-injury and suicide come into your thinking. So yes, there are three clusters of personality disorders, and borderline personality disorders, and what is called cluster B. It's the one that is the most researched and best studied. And so even though the others definitely exist, they're not as frequently targeted in clinical practice. We certainly see them under certain conditions, antisocial personality in prisons, populations and things like that. But really, more often than not, it's borderline personality disorder that brings someone into the clinic.
Jenny or Mark, Dr. Gary just mentioned something, that pain, right? That pain of like thinking of self-harm or suicide. It seems extreme to us, right? But to think that you were willing to do that self-harm because you are in that much pain. And is that what you see in your patients?
Yeah, it is. They really suffer, even though they can make you angry with some of their behaviors, and you don't want any part of it, so to speak. But they really do suffer. They suffer on the edge 24/7, really. They are so, like Dr. Aguirre said, they're so, Aguirre, I'm sorry, said that they're terrified of abandonment, and they don't have a steady view of themselves that goes through the day. Instead, they're in the moment, and they experience they're afraid of abandonment, and abandonment can come in a very small form, just a kind of a snub, or something. We just don't pay attention to them like they wanted to experience. That's abandonment. So they go from 0 to 60 in terms of range of bad results, with abandonment always being the primary fear that's over their head. It's a horrible way to exist, but some people, they experience this, and I've come to appreciate just how brave some people have been living with this for years.
Yeah. Jenny, want to add anything?
Yeah, I actually am interested in Dr. Aguirre talking about the sense of self, because my observation is that there's a lot in one old terms, projection. So they might have an explosive outburst that they feel is completely justified, and then they are hurt and confused by why people then do abandon them. So I think of a friend of ours who is borderline, who my husband had been very good friends for a long time. They had bought this beautiful bottle of port. They were planning this big party. He and I had just met. He and I talked beforehand about not even speaking to each other during that event, so that she knew she was the one with him there. But because she had it in her head that we were going to exclude her, she saw us excluding her, and she just blew up. And I didn't know her that well then, so I was like, I'm done. But as I got to know her better, I saw the multiplicity of her really wonderful, artistic, intelligent, thoughtful personality. But there's this cycle, right, where they blow up about tiny things because they feel abandoned, and then they do get abandoned.
Yeah. Dr. Gary, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, no one chooses borderline personality disorder.
Oh.
And no parent chooses borderline personality disorder for their kid. I've had kids. I had a young woman with an IQ of 160, and her dad kept saying, like, she's so bright, why can't she figure this out? But I said, you know, you can have asthma and you can have diabetes, and you can be really bright and you still can't figure it out. You know, just the fact that you're bright is irrelevant in this context. And so what happens is if you think about emotional or interactional slights equivalent to what peanut does to somebody with peanut allergies. Somebody with a peanut allergy eats a peanut, and then their body goes into anaphylaxis, or it goes into some sort of allergic reaction. For people with borderline personality disorder, the idea of abandonment, the idea of rejection, the rejection sensitivity is a trigger to kind of an emotional allergic response, and it's a magnified response. So to the outside observer, it's like a trivial situation. To the person with borderline personality disorder, it's a big response. To somebody who's not allergic to peanuts, a peanut is trivial. But to a person with peanut allergies, a single peanut can cause that big reaction. Mm-hmm. That's how I think about those things.
At what age do we see symptoms begin?
So people historically used to say to me that, the condition could not be diagnosed with under the age of 18. I used to, when I lectured on borderline personality disorder, I used to walk around with a check for $1,000. I increased it to $10,000. And I said, anybody who shows me where in the DSM it says that you cannot diagnose people with, under age 18, I'll give you $10,000. During my residency, it had to be $1,000. I wouldn't make that much money. It doesn't actually, that's just not a truth. And most people who tell me that with borderline personality disorder, most adults tell me that their suffering started in adolescence. And so what happens is that we tend to see it sometime after puberty. So it looks like the combination of being a very sensitive person, interacting with what we would call an invalidating environment, spurred on or fueled on by hormonal changes. And, you know, those hormonal changes are going to bring romantic relationships and ability to, you know, maybe get drugs and drive fast and stuff like that. That stew of different factors, tend to then lead the person on the path to borderline personality disorder or not. So I would say sometime after puberty. So, 13, 14, 15, mm-hmm. around there.
Jenny?
And then do you see a shift again during menopause and postmenopause?
So just to say that I work mostly with adolescents. What's interesting about your question is that over time, the part of borderline personality disorder that seems to be under better control is the so-called externalizing behaviors, a lot of the rage attacks, a lot of the self-injury, a lot of the anger outbursts, emotional roller coaster. What tends to stick around, and we see this throughout the lifespan, is that the sense of self is pretty poor, and we see a lot of self-hatred, self-judgment, self-disgust, self-shame, and that seems to persist even when a lot of the other behaviors seem to have died down. And very few people postmenopausal are diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, and no one that I've known in 25 years as a first-time diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So there is the steady decline of the behaviors that others can see, but the behaviors that are inside the mind don't change as much. And that's my new frontier. That I'm working on.
So for parents, who are thinking, what am I looking for symptoms in my teenager?
Yeah. So what are the kinds of behaviors that bring kids into treatment? So there's a whole range of behaviors and symptoms that would concern us in terms of mental health, broadly speaking. And certainly COVID has magnified a lot of this. We're seeing a lot of anxiety and depression. The types of things that we see in children and adolescents are relational issues that are characterized by an intensity in relationships, meaning that a kid might come home and said, I've just met my best friend. We're going to be best friends forever. So they've gone from 0 to 60 in terms of connecting with somebody that they feel bonded to. And then maybe 2 or 3 days later, they can say, I hate that person. I don't know what I saw in them. You know, they're the most awful person ever. So you see this, these extremes of idealization on the one hand and devaluation on the other hand. It turns out that the closer they are to the person, the more you see this, the intensity of the idealization and devaluation. So, you know, you might say, well, I don't see that happening in school, but maybe they're not close to some of their other friends. But generally, the closer they are, whether it's a parent, a sibling, a romantic partner, a best friend, you can see this idealization or devaluation. The other one is this intense fear of abandonment. And the abandonment fear is either real or imagined. So, for example, one thing is a person might say, you know what, you're too intense for me. You're too emotionally sensitive. I've had it. So that's real abandonment. Another might be, hey, let's get together later this afternoon. Oh, I forgot I had soccer practice. I'm not going to be able to see you. And then an interpretation that that isn't about soccer practice, rather that the reason that they're doing it is because they want to leave me and abandon me. So it's real or imagined. And then this is what's key, is what is labeled as frantic efforts to avoid this abandonment. And by this, it's a begging. It's a desperation. It is, you know, in the old days, it was phone calls. People would just call repeatedly, please don't leave me, etc. Now it's texting, it's messaging, but it's this desperation, and sometimes even behaviors that, you know, like self-injury or suicidal attempts, in an attempt to get the person to quote-unquote care. Ironically and tragically, often those are the very behaviors that get somebody to say, this is too much for me to handle. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in some cases, you know, that I don't want people to abandon me, but I do behaviors that get people to abandon me. And then I internalize the idea that I'm somebody that no one's going to love and is going to be abandoned. And when somebody then reconnects with the person, it's like, I need to see if they'll really stick around. So now that's not a conscious decision. It's just like, these are these cycles, these pattern cycles of interaction, you know, that tend to happen. And so that would be it. Then the other thing that's that we see in children and adolescents is a lot of self-injury, especially cutting, mostly arms and legs. Now, here's the other thing is, certainly substance use and dangerous sexual encounters. Now, what we need to make a distinction about is that adolescence is a time of experimentation. And adolescents are going to do what adolescents do. I was an adolescent. people still think of me as an adolescent at times. And my own kids have done, you know, stuff that, you know, risky and all that sort of thing. In people with borderline personality disorder, it's not about necessarily being an adolescent. The function of those behaviors often is to change how they feel about an experience. So maybe somebody wants to experiment with drugs, but for people with borderline personality disorder who are having these intense emotions, they want to change that feeling because they're intolerable. So we're more interested less in the behavior per se, and much more in the function of the behavior. Are you doing that thing in order to change how you're feeling about something, rather than just being an adolescent?
Yeah. We're talking about borderline personality disorder. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about borderline personality disorder with social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, and psychiatrist Blaise Aguirre, who is internationally recognized for his work in treatment of mood and personality disorders in adolescents. He's the director of McLean Hospital's 3 East Continuum, which focuses on BPD treatment. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jenny, I wanted to say something before we went to the break.
Yeah, Dr. Gill was just saying that the thing about the difference between adolescence and borderline personality disorder. And I was thinking about your comment that, I mean, I too have heard this, you can't diagnose someone pre-18, but I have definitely seen kids who display all of the symptoms of borderline personality disorder. But I think it is important for most clinicians to be careful when calling a teenager borderline, because teenage behavior does look very much like borderline behavior, and sort of the you're my best friend, you're not my best mm-hmm. friend, especially in sort of 14, 15, 16 year old girls, is very prevalent. Those fights, those, that's part of the normal part of development for teenage girls. I don't know if you want to talk about that. I think you already very clearly outlined the differences, but I do think for clinicians, be careful when diagnosing someone under 18.
Okay. Yeah, I think that two things about that. Generally, when somebody comes in with clinical concerns about their child, say they're 15 years old, who's self-injuring, who's got very toxic relationships and those sorts of things, who later on will go on to really develop the full-blown syndrome of borderline personality disorder. What would happen is that historically, either one of two things would happen. One clinician would say, oh, well, that's just being an adolescent, you know? And so they would dismiss a parent's concern of saying that that's just typical adolescent behavior, which it isn't. The other thing is they'd say, well, yes, I can see that you're really concerned about your child. So they say, well, what is it? What do they have? So they said, well, given I can't diagnose borderline personality disorder, I'm going to call them bipolar. So now what they've done is they've called them bipolar, and they say there's a psychiatrist, put them on medications that are going to treat bipolar disorder. And then two things happen. One is they have horrible side effects to the medications. Yeah. And two, they don't work because no medication works for bipolar borderline personality disorder. Now these children don't trust the mental health system because they've been sold a bill of goods. The way I think about it is it's less about the diagnosis in the sense of saying, yes, congratulations, we won, you've got the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. It's more about thinking, you know, the way we see it is it's a skills deficit problem. These children don't have the skills to be able to manage strong emotions, difficult relationships. So we're going to teach them the skills, and that these are symptomatic of borderline personality disorder. But I spend a lot of time in my diagnosis really looking at the function of what the behavior is. So if somebody is using drugs because they're hanging out with their friends and it doesn't matter, that is different from somebody who feels so desperate that they need to do drugs. The other thing that's interesting, the two other interesting elements, is that 80% of kids correctly diagnosed feel tremendous relief.
Yeah.
And here's the other interesting thing is there's a new diagnostic and statistical manual, and it's called TikTok. What happens is that kids get on TikTok and they find all these celebrities and other people who say they have BPD. They then go online and they research it and they say, hey, that sounds a lot like me. You know, so I'm open about talking about it, but I want to take your caution that simply labeling behavior in an adolescent that you don't like as borderline does the child a great disservice and does the disorder and the clinical condition a great disservice as well.
Let's go to Sarah, who's giving us a call from the Boston area. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call. Sure. I was wondering if those with BPD, those that I've been in contact with, often are very resistant to being labeled as such. Often, and I'm wondering if this is true, if it is caused by abandonment by their parents, they seem not to have insight, resent the diagnosis. And what does one do with that? You can't really medicate a personality disorder. And if they're in denial that they have it, they're resistant to therapy. And I was wondering how, if any of this is accurate, or what is the most effective way to deal with someone who does not want the diagnosis?
Yeah, well, nobody, I don't think anybody would want the diagnosis, right? And this, with any kind of mental illness, there's a stigma. Go ahead, Dr. Gary.
Yeah, so this is such an important question. So firstly, if there's no treatment for something, then why would you want to be diagnosed with that thing? That's the first thing. The second thing is many of these young people have experienced tremendous stigma and rejection from having these conditions. And one of our experiences is that many people who come to our treatment have had years and years of psychotherapy, and they haven't gotten better. Yeah. So they become really skeptical. If I had a condition and I kept going to doctors to try to get help for it, and I never got help for it, I would become bitter. I would become cynical. I wouldn't want that condition. But you know, with a treatment like ours, dialectical behavior therapy, there's new hope, and there's a way of dealing with this condition. So as I say, 80% of people who come to us and who are correctly diagnosed with the condition actually find tremendous relief. And when we explain how our treatment maps onto the difficulties that they're experiencing, it finally makes sense. Coming and saying, okay, well, sit on the couch and then talk to me about your problems isn't going to cure a skills deficit. Mm-hmm. So I understand the skepticism of many people with BPD of saying, like, I don't know, I'm not going to get any help because I've tried it and it hasn't worked.
Yeah. Sarah, thanks for the call. So talk a little bit about the treatment. You're not using drugs. What is the treatment that you focus on?
So, you know, so what do we see? We see people who have emotion regulation problems. So we have a skill called emotion regulation skills. We have people who have a great difficulty tolerating distress. So we have a skill set called distress tolerance skills. We have people who have great difficulty in interpersonal relationships. So we have a skill set called interpersonal effectiveness skills. And then we have people who they have such a hard time staying present. They're living in a future that doesn't exist, with terror and fear and abandonment, or in a past that was toxic and traumatizing. And so they can't be present. So we have a skill set called mindfulness, which keeps them present. And when we package these ideas together in the present moment, lives start to change in a very powerful way. So it really, the therapy maps onto the problems that they're having. You know, it maps onto the skills deficits that we see.
Mark, you want to add something?
Yeah, I just want to add one other dimension from neuroscience that has been that reinforces this treatment approach and reinforces nature of the condition too. And that is that the brain is really a prediction machine. That's how it operates. 24/7, it's always predicting. We're not necessarily aware of it, but our unconscious brain is really predicting what's going to happen. The people with borderline personality get into a loop of always predicting abandonment, catastrophe, loss, based on some past experiences. And like we said before, they precipitate some abandonment, some rejection, and it just reinforces it. So the prediction is validated. And furthermore, cements it. What you're describing is a way of actually mentalizing, I guess you could say, this process and trying to have the person learn to kind of watch their brain working as opposed to being in their brain working, like watching a movie, watching a TV a program. It really is fascinating once you develop that skill, mindfulness skill, because if anything, it satisfies immense curiosity about how your brain works and who you are without judgment. This is easy to say, roll off the tongue, but for them to actually get the skill is something else.
Yeah.
Maybe you could say something about how difficult it is to teach what makes sense in DBT, dialectical behavior therapy.
Right. Actually, I remember I had a patient who was very, very, very upset. And she says, listen, I need to get better. I was, I'm very, very upset. I'm very emotionally dysregulated and everything. Just, I need a medication. I need something. And I said, mindfulness. She said, mindfulness is BS. I said, well, I'm not talking about it for you. I'm talking about it for me to deal with the likes of you because you're so dysregulated. But I said, but what happened is, she says, well, I hear you're good at mindfulness. Can you help me out? Now, a person who's dysregulated cannot think. Imagine that you're trying to learn mathematics, but your house is on fire. Me trying to teach you addition, subtraction, multiplication isn't going to work because you're so worried about what's happening. The same thing happens in the brain. The dysregulated brain cannot learn. So you have to regulate before you can reflect. So what I did with this young person is I said, we went and outside the hospital and there's a grassy area and we just lay on the ground. And I said, what do you see? And we spent quite a lot of time seeing the ants and seeing the grass and all of that. And she says, this is all great and everything. And I said, but when are we going to start therapy? So after an hour, we stood up and I said, how are you feeling right now? And she said, I'm feeling much better. When are we going to start therapy? And I said, but you see, you came in very upset. You started to pay attention to what was, and now you're not upset anymore. What's the therapy that you need? What was the thing that got you so upset? It's not impacting you so much, but do you see how by bringing your attention to the present moment, you're able to regulate? Now you can go and deal with whatever it is that was upsetting you. You know, because you've got the skill set to be able to do that. You just don't have it when you're dysregulated. So I'm going to teach you how to regulate. So that's just an example of a situation that I did with a kid.
Let's talk to Sarah, who's giving us a call from Chilmark. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about how having a parent with BPD affects the children, which is something I have indirect experience with.
It's very painful, to see children of parents with BPD because the child themselves, you know, as Mark was saying, is that the brain's a prediction machine. And, you know, what happens frequently is something that someone then begins to predict over time. If you've got a parent with borderline personality disorder, predicting how they're going to be is very, very difficult. And when they're your primary objects of connection and those primary attachment objects or people aren't predictable, it becomes confusing. And certainly we know that children of people with BPD are more likely to develop borderline personality than those who are not. And that's much more an environmental load as well as the genetic load. So one of the things that, you know, under best conditions, a parent self is identified as having BPD, and then they get into treatment, and then the child, it sort of validates the child's experience. But we've certainly seen situations where a parent doesn't recognize that they have BPD, and it's very, very difficult for the kid. Yeah. And having a validating person in their life is key.
Yeah, Sarah, thank you for the phone call. You mentioned genetics versus environment. Do we know what causes BPD and how much of that is genetic?
We don't. As with any complex condition, there are environmental factors and genetic factors. Most research shows that it's about 60% genetic and about 40% environmental. What the elements of the genetics are and what the elements of the environment are, you know, we're trying to understand a little bit more. Certainly the environmental factors are things like trauma, emotional, physical, sexual trauma, as well as the so-called invalidating environment, one that rejects the child's experience. But none of those are necessary nor sufficient in and of themselves to cause the condition. So it seems like that there has to be this blend of genetic vulnerability as well as environmental factors, somewhere around 60-40.
We are talking about borderline personality disorder. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about borderline personality disorder with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, social worker Jenny Putnam, and psychiatrist Blaise Aguirre, who is internationally recognized for his work in treatment of mood and personality disorders in adolescents. He's the director of McLean Hospital's 3 East Continuum, which focuses on BPD treatment. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. When you have these intense emotional responses, it can make you feel very misunderstood, right? And alone. Nobody gets me. And I'm kind of coming back to, we heard this word judgment a little bit earlier. And that judgment can be real or perceived, right? So, I mean, they're struggling with those emotions, but also struggling with this, nobody understands me. I'm all alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if I were to take you to a Rwandan village and then just dropped you there, and then, you know, and then you had to interact with the people, you'd say, they don't speak my language, they don't eat my food, they don't enjoy the things that I do. Like, I feel very, very misunderstood and alone. And for people who have very, very intense emotions to seeming small provocations, it's that kind of experience. It's like, you know, other people seem to either not care about the event or seem to get over it very, very quickly, but I don't. And so you know, is there something wrong with me? Like, why don't people understand how painful this is for me? So it's got that kind of equivalence, you know, that there's just at an emotional level, you're an emotional alien, you're an emotional, you know, stranger.
Jenny?
Yeah, I'm curious about, you know, you've mentioned trauma a couple times. You've talked about how as people get older, the outward behaviors change, but the inward perceptions don't. And I have found, certainly with adolescents who have gone to McLean for DBT training, that the combination of that kind of intervention plus EMDR, which is what I do, seems to make a big, big difference. And so I'm curious if you ever combine, you know, standard trauma treatments, maybe trauma-informed CBT or something with the DBT. And I also am curious if you know of a woman named Dolores Mosquera who does a lot of EMDR work. She's Spanish with personality disorders and seems to have a lot of success with them.
So I don't know her. I mean, I'm also fluent in Spanish. My mother's Spanish, and so I do work with people with personality disorders in Spanish. But I don't know her. The way so two things. One is we use something called prolonged exposure. So that, first of all, the majority of people who are traumatized don't end up with PTSD. I mean, you can see people who go to Vietnam and they're tragically living in homeless shelters. Others go to Vietnam and run for president of the United States. So just because you've had traumatic experiences doesn't mean you're going to have you know, a trauma impact or PTSD. In people who we diagnose with having comorbid PTSD, we do DBT plus this combination of prolonged exposure for the treatment of that PTSD. And certainly in people who have untreated PTSD and who have comorbid borderline personality disorder, if the PTSD is not treated, it remains a huge risk factor for suicide. Mm-hmm. So it has to be treated. So you're absolutely right. And people like my friend and colleague Bessel van der Kolk, who does a lot, is very interested in treatments like EMDR.
He knows Dolores for sure.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Mark?
Yeah, about DBT, in the community, it's hard to find.
Yeah.
You know that. Mm-hmm. And that's why you got quite a wide range of people trying to get your services. So And one of the things that I know about DBT is that the therapist has to be available to the patient 24/7, at least in the beginning of the work. That turns a lot of therapists away. It's a very difficult thing to accomplish, because that's what they need to have an attachment to you. Mm-hmm. They need to have a bit of a holding experience that doesn't turn out to be toxic with the psychotherapy itself. What can you say about how hard it is to obtain the DBT, which is the only treatment that has any evidence to helping borderline personality disorder, and makes so much sense because of what the deficits are?
Right. I mean, there are other theories of borderline personality disorder. So I'm also practiced in MBT, mentalizing-based therapy, which is a different has a different theory behind it. It's more psychodynamic, more attachment-based, and works a lot on mentalizing, which is the idea that I have a mind and you have a mind, and that those minds, just because you think something doesn't mean that that thing is true, and I might be reacting to whatever's going on in my mind. But let's just put that aside for a second. And say two things. So I have about 400 former patients. They all have my cell phone number. They don't call me, partly because two things. One is they're very respectful of my time. Secondly, they're only going to call me if they need help in the moment. What a lot of therapists get into trouble with is that they get into a psychotherapy session with their patients and don't get the patients off the phone, and that begins to impact their life and the patient's life. So it's very clear that if you're going to call me, A, you have to be able to tolerate whatever you're in until I'm able to get back to you, and B, it's just going to be for coaching. And if you think about if you play tennis, if I were to say, hey, by the way, 3 weeks ago, your tennis swing was incorrect. What was my tennis swing 3 weeks ago? If the coach is there in the moment, they can help you in the moment. So first of all, just that thing about coaching. The second thing is this. It seems that the mediating factor in dialectical behavior therapy is the skills acquisition, because people can then map that onto their skills deficit. So one thing that many groups have done, especially under resourced areas or places where they don't have that many therapists, is to actually run skills group, DBT skills group. So for the majority of people, remember, I'm treating people with severe borderline personality disorder. Most people don't need to be inpatient or in residential treatment. Most people can function pretty well outside. So if I were a therapist in the community interested in DBT, I would learn about DBT and I would teach the DBT skills in group contexts. I don't think that you necessarily need an individual DBT therapist. You need a therapist who has compassion and who recognizes the skills deficit problem and then can work with this group therapist. But that's what I would do in terms of that.
Let's talk to Bob, who's giving us a call from Sandwich. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead, Bob.
Hi. So I'm a psychotherapist of many years, actually just retired. I've learned more about CBT, borderline today than I've ever known. So thank you for this smart and in-depth conversation. Even though I've retired, I have a borderline child of a borderline mother that I've been working with since he was 14. He's about 26 now. And I work from a mindfulness and a gestaltish point of view. And right now I've just told him, don't worry about paying me and don't worry about anything. I've retired and I'm your friend for life. And my God, that helped.
Yeah.
That's just helped, that he knows that I'm there for him. And I think that's the message that you've been saying and most recently. However, all that said, when I first saw him, I was sure he was OCD. Then I thought he was bipolar. Then I thought it was so confusing for us. And I don't know. I just hope this program gets widely distributed, and I want to thank you for it. I don't really have a question.
Yeah.
I don't think, other than Am I digging a bigger hole for myself saying, no, I'm just going to hang it. I'm 75. I'll be around for a long time.
You know, I really appreciate that. So I have a patient who was then 17 years old, who was certain that she would have been dead by now. Fast forward, she's in her mid-30s, living in out of state with three kids, is becoming a nurse, and is absolutely wonderful. And she flies in once a year. They'll go to a Red Sox game, and we go out and we have a cup of coffee, and I meet her family, and the relationship's a real relationship. I'm so proud of her. Earlier last year, I went to a former patient's wedding. You know, I love to see that they've entered the mainstream of life, able to function, sensitive as they are, compassionate as they are, able to manage these difficult emotions. So, you know, I think that, you know, one thing is during the therapeutic relationship, but then post-therapy, it's not that, you know, having them over for dinner necessarily, but yeah, going out for coffee and seeing what they're doing with their lives, I think is perfectly healthy.
Yeah. Jenny?
I would say that even in the office, without even going that far, that one of my most successful people, every time she would get up and start to storm out of the office, and I would say, sit down, let's figure out what's going on. That got her a little less likely to have those fits, because I was saying, no, I'm still in here, even though you're doing that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, and this is in keeping with the, two minds piece, is I would encourage them to tell me what they were thinking that I was doing, and not sort of say, that's ridiculous, but say, oh, I can see how you would think that that's what was going on. That wasn't what was going on inside for me, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And so those two interventions, though I think probably DBT works quicker and, you know, longer, that even without knowing all of those things back when I started, that really made a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. Mark?
No, I love these stories, yeah. and they illustrate some hope, really.
Yeah,
that, you know, I trained a long time ago, and there wasn't too much hope.
Yeah.
For borderline people, but now there is, and even if you don't know as a mental health professional, even if you don't know DBT, you can still utilize the concepts of coaching, of skill development, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I want to thank Bob for calling in and sharing that story.
Yeah.
And in the last couple of minutes we have, let's touch on, end on the happy note. The prognosis now is pretty good, right, Dr. Aguirre?
Yeah. I mean, so we were told that, that maybe 10% of people with borderline personality disorder would take their lives. And certainly for people, for clinical populations, you know, that was the statistic that was sort of thrown around, which is, and if you think about a condition that impacts about 2% of the population in the United States, that's a huge number, a lot of suffering. But what we've seen is a marked reduction in people who are getting the kind of treatment that targets borderline personality disorder, marked reduction in suicide and self-destructive behaviors. Now, the part that remains is this internal negative self-talk, but I think with practices such as mindfulness, loving compassion, and then success at their own life, people, that begins to erode. And so the prognosis is just much, much better than what we used to think. And as I say, you know, many of the first patients that I treated in my early cohorts are now married or fully employed or in stable relationships. And it's absolutely wonderful to see. And, you know, every now and then I get a phone call from a spouse who says, it's a bit intense, but they manage very well.
Psychiatrist Blaise Aguirre, social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Thank you all. Fascinating hour. Thanks for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.